决定的。
Although I use the gavel, this is not a committee hearing, and it's not a session of the House chamber. So there will be no prayer by the chaplain today, everyone, but I just wanted to get your attention and have you get seated. Members of the House, Senate, legislative staff, and distinguished guests, we are so glad that you're with us today. Thank you for showing your concern about the future of our state and the state of the world by being here today for this potentially historic moment, and when we focus on the topic of global climate change. Minnesota is and has been defined by our bounty of natural resources. We are the land of 10,000 lakes, the source of the Mississippi, the breadbasket to the nation. Our natural resources are an inherent element of our heritage, an essential resource to our livelihood, and a vital component of our future. But our legacy is threatened. The alarm on global climate change has been sounded, and now is the time for us to act. 6 years ago, prominent scientists from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change found conclusive evidence that through global warming, we humans are threatening our global environment. Top scientists at NASA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, President Bush's science advisor, have all since joined the alarm and are now calling the attention of the world's leaders on an enormous scale, on the enormous scale of this problem and the need for immediate and effective solutions. Beyond the science community, businesses across Minnesota and the nation have highlighted the impacts of global warming on the economy. I know for the members who attended the session at the Humphrey Institute, we heard from business leaders who talked about this as one of the most important issues facing us. These leaders are calling for us and our leadership in cutting fossil fuel emissions to reduce the economic damages and pursue new energy industries that will bring jobs and economic gain to our state. Furthermore, faith leaders from many denominations, two of whom will address us today, have issued calls for legislative action to find solutions to this growing problem based on the moral imperatives of their faith traditions. The Minnesota legislature has a historic opportunity before us, both today and in this session, to listen to the voices of concern, to listen to the alarm that they are sounding, and to take the lead on new policies that reduce the negative impacts of global warming and climate change and create a clean and innovative low-carbon economy for our state. As a mom, I know that if we leave this work to our children, it may be too late. Left unintended, the impacts of climate change will do further and perhaps irreparable damage to both our natural resources and our many industries that depend on those natural resources. These industries include agriculture, forestry, tourism, transportation, energy, and more. We're not dealing with theories or fantasies or myths. Instead, we are dealing with the cold, hard truth that's been ignored for far too long. world is no longer flat in the minds of mankind, the fact that the warming of the earth can no longer be ignored. Yesterday, the alarm on climate change was sounded at maybe a whisper. Today, the alarm is deafening. It is now time for us to act. The future of our state depends on this. Thank you for being here today. And now please join me in welcoming Archbishop Harry Flynn of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis and Reverend Craig E. Johnson, the Bishop of Minneapolis Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
Good afternoon. And good afternoon, Madam Speaker, and I thank you and members of the legislature. I am, as the Madam Speaker stated, Archbishop Harry Flynn of the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and I am here today speaking on the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which represents the Roman Catholic bishops from each of the six dioceses in Minnesota. Thank you for providing me with this opportunity to share our perspective on this matter with you this afternoon. Global warming is an important issue for the state of Minnesota and the entire human family. As a faith community, we take seriously the threat that global warming presents and seek to participate in the solutions. I am here to ask that, as you develop public policies this legislative session, you bear in mind the urgency of addressing the moral and human dimensions of climate change. Care for creation is a key principle of Catholic social teaching. Rooted in Scripture, the Catholic tradition asserts that the earth and its goods are gifts from God. They are intended by God for the benefit of everyone. Humankind has a responsibility to care for these goods as stewards, not as mere consumers and users. How we treat the environment is a measure of our stewardship and a sign of our respect for the Creator. In 2001, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops did a thorough examination of how stewardship of God's creation provides a lens for addressing the warming of the earth's atmosphere. We bishops published a statement called Global Climate Change, a plea for dialogue, prudence, and the common good. Allow me to share with you some of our reflections. First, the United States bishops accept the findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that global climate change is occurring and is at least partially a result of human behavior. What we already know about global warming demands a response. Secondly, our national debate over solutions to global warming needs to move beyond the uses and abuses of science, 60-second ads, and exaggerated claims. The atmosphere that supports life on Earth is a God-given gift, one that unites us as a human family. We must all strive for a civil and constructive debate that recognizes our common future of tomorrow and requires that we act for the common good today. Thirdly, global warming demands a response from all levels of government. The Minnesota legislature should be among the leaders in our country, creating momentum for our nation to lead the global effort. Finally, we cannot forget the poorest members of the human family, who will bear the greatest hardship of global warming. Scientists predict that global warming will induce a greater incidence of extreme weather and violent storms. As Hurricane Katrina taught us with such fearful clarity, the poor are too easily left behind when weather catastrophes occur. The human family has a moral responsibility to act when the dignity of the poor and the vulnerable is placed at risk. In the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis, we have taken on a unique, faithful response to global warming by convening a global warming action team. The team is made of parishioners from throughout the Archdiocese. We are addressing global warming through concrete everyday actions, including changing to energy-efficient light bulbs, using public transportation more often, and conducting energy audits of parish facilities. Such efforts make up an important component of the solution to global warming. I urge you to enact wise public policies in Minnesota that build upon such efforts so that you might help to avoid the worst effects of global warming and hopefully to begin to reverse the damage that has already been done. John Paul II, our late Holy Father, said very well, "We cannot interfere in one area of the ecosystem without paying due attention both to the consequences of such interference in other areas and to the well-being of future generations." On behalf of the Catholic Bishops of Minnesota, and certainly on my behalf, I thank you for your consideration and for your hard work on behalf of the citizens of this great state. Thank you.
Madam Speaker, I want to thank you for this opportunity to address this body, and I want to thank all of you for being here today to listen. I have learned that if I stay with my discipline, which is theology and biblical study, everyone is better off. So that is how I will frame my remarks today. The ancient writers of Holy Scripture had a great biblical theme that in the creation of the world, the universe, God brought about a change from chaos to ordered creation. That made life possible. This was a creative act from disorder, chaos, to an ordered creation. Within this creation, humankind emerged and was given the critical task to till and watch over the creation, to be a steward of the earth. Genesis 2, verse 15. Over the eons, we have done a lot more tilling than stewarding. But for the issue at hand of environmental calamity and care, there is another biblical theme which emerges out of the book of Exodus. This scriptural theme is poignant to the conversation about climate change and global warming. When the Pharaoh of Egypt oppressed the enslaved Israelites, he was given a choice of letting God's people go or suffer enormous environmental consequences. He stood his oppressive ground and touched off environmental catastrophes in his country, witnessed in the plagues. The biblical understanding for us today, and which we can draw today, is that oppressive acts are decreative and can bring the world a step back toward chaos, political and or environmental. In the Exodus, the chaos occurred because of enormous oppression. And that occurrence can be seen again and again, especially in our modern era, where oppression sparks war, and war's counterpart, environmental catastrophe. Here we are in a time of unusual climatic events, many of which are thought to be caused by global warming. Because we have not watched over the creation and have sent millions of tons of pollution into the air, we are beginning to see in these decreative acts of polluting the possibility of a new return or step toward chaos. We have oppressed the earth. The way through is to affirm and follow the biblical imperative to watch over, to steward, to guard the earth as God intended. We have oppressed our environment since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and now the beginning throes of chaos seem to have emerged. I would urge you, as our civil leaders, to begin to decrease that oppression so the world which we are able to watch over and nurture can heal. We must be steadfastly focused to be stewards of the earth that God has given to our care. This is going to be a long journey, perhaps 100 years or more. I plead with you to begin this year to boldly step forward with continued scientific research, development of new clean technologies in power generation and transportation, an energy economy less dependent on fossil fuels, and targets and timetables for the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. We, as a mighty and affluent nation, have a moral obligation to help to protect the poor and work with them with our new technologies. Long journeys of 100 years begin with the first step. Please make it a bold, courageous first step. God bless you and your work. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your words. I want to first briefly thank all the Senate and House staff who worked very hard to put the logistics of this event together. Thank you so much. And I also want to announce that we'd like, after the next 4 speakers, to hold all questions until the end. And then we will take questions as long as people are willing to be here. It's wonderful to have Will Seeger back here with us at the State Capitol. He last testified in my committee about 2 years ago, but it was a lot smaller room and a lot less people, so this is very exciting. As one of Minnesota's homegrown heroes, Will Seeger's accomplishments are very well known. His 1986 polar expedition by dog sled is believed to be the first expedition to reach the North Pole without resupply. In 1990, Will Seeger became the 4th person ever to reach both the North Pole and the South Pole, and he's the first person to reach both the North Pole and the South Pole by dog sled. But when I asked Will how he wanted to be introduced, he said, he's an educator. And so it's really important to talk about how he has used every one of his expeditions and his work around the world as an opportunity to connect with and teach children. And he continues to do that. People around the world admire Will for his incredible bravery and for pushing the limits of what humans can accomplish. But now what Will Seeger has taken on is possibly the greatest challenge of all. And it might take more bravery and more endurance than anything he's done before. And that is to try to teach all of us about the real threat of global warming and get us to take action. With that, Will Seeger.
Thank you, Senator Anderson and Madam Speaker and members of the House and Senate. I want to thank you for the opportunity today to be able to present my observations about global warming in the Arctic. I've traveled in the Arctic for about 43 years now. In the last 15 years, we've seen incredible changes in both polar areas, especially the northern regions of the Arctic. And these areas are basically unseen by most people. I traveled thousands of miles in areas where no people have ever been. The scientists have predicted some of these changes, but really, very few people have seen them. And that's the reason I have been so motivated here, is that I've seen the reality of global warming as predicted up north, and global warming is coming our way here. So what I wanted to do this afternoon was, first of all, I want to show you via some slides, observations. After that, I have some quotes from the elders, the Inuit elders, Eskimo elders of the north. And then I'm going to talk very briefly about the tours I've taken in the last year and a half, talking to many Minnesotans around our state. This picture here is the North Pole, 1995, aerial shot here of our base camp. We crossed the Arctic Ocean from Russia to the pole to Canada that year. There are a couple of tipping points. A tipping point is an area like a weather system or a ice system that is pushed to a maximum and all of a sudden it changes. Nature doesn't occur on one tipping point after another. Everything is interrelated. But for the sake of showing you these observations, I want to talk about, I'm going to refer to the tipping points. The one first tipping point is the loss of the summer sea ice in the Arctic. And this is a good photograph here of what the Arctic, or what the North Pole, the Arctic Ocean, which is about the size of the United States, probably a little bigger than that, what it looks like year-round. It's basically ice and snow. And this, any radiation from the sunlight, in other words, in the summertime that hits this ice surface, about 99% of that energy reflects back into outer space. So this is what the Arctic Ocean looks like. That ice thickness 20 years ago was a little over 8 feet. Now it's just a little over 5 feet thick. So we're starting to lose that in terms of thickness. We are also losing it in area. This shows you what the Arctic Ocean and what this ice looks like from the ground level. You know, it's just nothing but ice. It's a real dynamic surface. It's breaking apart in some areas. At the North Pole, the water is about 15,000 feet deep. That's 3 miles of water covered by this layer of snow and ice. This is the top of the globe here. And what we're looking at here, the North Pole would be here, Arctic Ocean. And this whole area north of the Arctic Circle is covered by snow and ice, except for a short summertime period. But over the last 5,000 years, we've had a pretty remarkable stable climate. It was stable mainly because we had this cool surface on the top of the globe, and that counterbalanced the warmer equatorial systems. And that counterbalance is done mainly by ocean currents, some weather currents, like the Gulf Stream, for example, flows from India, Africa, then up the coast. It keeps northwestern Europe warm. And what we're seeing here then on the Arctic Ocean now, because of the rise of the concentration of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels, the atmosphere is getting warmer. It's like putting on sweaters over your body. The warmer, the more carbon dioxide, the warmer the Earth gets. This scientific fact has never been disputed. 100 years ago, they knew for a fact. You add carbon dioxide, the Earth warms up. And the scenario that we had in the past was reflected sunlight. This would be in the second to the top here. The normal summer that we had prior to 15 years ago, we have a little bit of absorption. But this is what we're starting to see now in the Arctic regions. We're seeing a loss of that snow cover and ice on the Arctic Ocean and the land. In other words, how that's playing out, you're getting earlier springs, later falls. So that summer season is enlarging. We're losing a percentage of the ice. And like a domino effect, we're starting to absorb more energy. And this is the reason why the Arctic today is warming 3 to 5 times faster than up here, because we're starting to lose that reflective area. This is what we're heading for. In 2040, the scientists have predicted that we would lose the entire sea ice of the northern hemisphere in the summertime. That means all the energy that used to reflect off the top of the globe would now be absorbed into the Earth. And this is the summer sea ice in the September year of 1979, just to give you an idea. September is when we have the least amount of snow and ice, This is 2003. You notice here, I'll run that back once. We've lost about a third of that. Actually, the record warm year again, 2005, was even less than that. So we're starting to see this situation on the Arctic Ocean, the breakup of the summer sea ice. Now, the polar bears, the walrus, many ice seals that rely on ice, are doomed for extinction here unless we act very, very promptly. The bears rely on sea ice to hunt seals. 98% of their diet comes from seal meat. They can't live on shore when there's no ice. They're not like the brown bear, so they rely on this. This bear population now is starting to head on the line for extinction. Within 20 years from now, the bear population will most likely drop off. And this is a dead bear. I traveled on a Russian research vessel in northeastern Greenland last year in September. We found a number of starved-to-death bears. This bear was about just fur and bones, 300 pounds. Normally they weigh about 1,700 pounds. We found a number of bears that were cannibalized by other bears. We actually have a video of adult bear literally eating a small cub that was an adult bear that was starving. This whole area between Norway and northeastern Greenland was normally frozen. It's an area about the size of the southwestern United States. It used to be solid ice in the summer. That's now open ocean for 5 months out of the year. The bears now are coming on land. The relation to people on land, totally different. I would never really worry too much about polar bears. I would always carry a gun, of course. A bear is dangerous is because they're curious. Now, in the summertime, when they're on land, they're extremely dangerous. They're getting into communities. They're hunting down children. So the whole relationship, the human relationship of bears to people, are changing. Heard our two bishops talking about the moral imperative of making sound policy change immediately. We have the Inuit, or the Eskimo culture here, is at risk. Like the polar bear, they rely on the sea ice to survive and to hunt. They rely on Baffin Island, the area that we're traveling to in 10 days. They get 80% of their food from animals that live on the ice. Last year, their hunting season was reduced from 8 months to 4 months because of global warming. And this is entirely changing the culture as we know it. For us, it would be like taking away our fishing, our hunting, everything that we do, everything that our culture represents. This is literally what's happening. These poor people do not have a voice. The global warming has been a reality for 15 years. I was up there 15 years ago. Very obvious. Of course, no one listened in those days. This is the top of the globe. We're looking at Alaska here, the Aleutian Peninsula, to get a location, Greenland. The white areas here are called permafrost. Large areas, 6 million square miles of permafrost in the northern hemisphere. Permafrost is basically frozen bog and swamp. And as long as this bog and swamp is frozen in a solid state, it does not interact with the atmosphere. But what happens when the permafrost thaws, when it gets above 32 degrees, you start getting a decomposition of the organic materials, and it releases methane and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Methane is 21 times more dangerous than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. I testified in Congress in 1990 about the dangers of global warming, thawing the permafrost, releasing methane and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. This is now happening. If you lived in Nome, Alaska, even 10 years ago, and you said you didn't believe in global warming, you'd probably be run out of town. Anywhere in the Arctic, in the Alaskan areas, whole infrastructures, houses, roads are collapsing because of this thawing of the permafrost. But the real danger is you can always relocate a city or a town, but the real danger is the rise of the carbon dioxide. This would be like a second tipping point. These are all interrelated. They're not just one at a time. This is the permafrost in the wintertime. You really can't tell if it's frozen lake or bog. It's just a kind of a barrens, nothing interacting with the atmosphere. This is in the summertime in northern Ellesmere, a short summer of about 6 weeks. Permafrost here right underneath the dogs. If you were to dig down about 6 to 8 inches, you hit solid ground. That's the frozen bog here that I'm talking about. Again, a diagram of the northern hemisphere. Alaska right here, Minnesota, if you can see that from the back. The permafrost areas, the green areas, the very deep fog, bogs that are 20 to 100 to 200 feet thick that are frozen. This is as it is right now. If we continue emitting carbon dioxide at the same level that we're doing now for the next 50 years, business as usual, this is what we're going to see. We're going to lose 50% of the permafrost in the summertime. If we continue at the rate that we're going, 100 years from now, we'll lose 90% of the permafrost. I want to just redo this to show you the seriousness of this. Okay, look at the green and visualize that as methane, carbon dioxide. It's frozen. It's not interacting. Whoops. And 50 years later, or as it slowly decays, what's happening? That methane, carbon dioxide goes from the ground into the atmosphere. This would be utterly catastrophic if this ever happened. Even the 50-year variation, we'd have warm temperatures that we haven't seen for many geographic eras. There's another tipping point is the loss of the ice shelves along the great continents, Antarctica. First of all, I'm going to show you the... this would be South America, Argentina, Chile, and right across is Drake Passage, is this area called the Antarctic Peninsula, this section that's Minnesota for a size comparison. And this is, again, a better view of Antarctica, the whole size of Antarctica. Along the coastline of Antarctica, there are these huge ice shelves. These ice shelves were laid down, scientists think, about 10,000 years ago. They're 1,000 to 2,000 to 3,000 feet thick. They're floating on the ocean themselves, but they buttress against the continent. And what these ice shelves do is they hold back these huge continental glaciers that flow down into the ocean. So as long as the ice shelves are there, the glaciers are in place. But what we're starting to see is the disintegration of some of these ice shelves. And the latest disintegration, the largest one, was 2004, the Larsen ice shelf, which I'm going to show you a picture here, right here. Back to the peninsula. The Larsen here in Minnesota for size comparison. This was a route we did in 1989 when we crossed Antarctica. It took us 31 days to cross the Larsen, about 320 miles across. This is an area called the Larsen A, this flat area, which again, 1,000 feet thick. There's a peninsula that sticks out across here, the larger Larsen B ice shelf. This is what the Larsen looks like on land. We traveled by dog team as usual. These are very historical pictures because we were the last... last expedition ever to travel across this, because it's now all gone. This is what it looks like here, the Larsen A ice shelf going up to that peninsula that I showed you, mountain range that we had to cross, and then down on the other side, the larger Larsen B ice shelf here. I have some satellite photos here, January 21st, 2002. This was that peninsula. You notice Larsen A here disintegrated in 1995 suddenly, caught the scientists completely off surprise. The photos I'm going to show you is this section here, the Larsen B ice shelf. It's 200 miles across here. Again, 2002. What happened here is we had the usual record warm temperatures on the peninsula that year. And probably for the first time ever in 10,000 years, about 10 feet of the ice on the surface of the Larsen melted down, forming these large lakes. Now, when you have, you're familiar with ice fishing, if you have eight inches of ice, you can drive a truck over it. But if that ice gets wet at all, it becomes real soggy fast. So what happened here with the big lakes, that water trickled down through the 1,000 feet of ice. And what happened suddenly, on right after that date, a large section of the Larsen here, size of a small New England site, half the size of Rhode Island, broke off. And then this caused the chain reaction. Within 4 weeks here, this entire ice shelf totally disintegrated into the ocean. Now, this is a planetary event. This is absolute positive that this is a global warming event. What's scary about this is that it caught the scientists by surprise. Their models have been fairly accurate. However, their models that they projected to now and then has been very conservative. We're getting new reports out this week in Science, and I think you're going to see the models are going to go way up, much more than we thought. This is a large ice shelf on the northern Ellesmere. If you traveled as far north in North America as you could go, this would be your last piece of real estate. This is in 1986, temperature 72 below zero here. We were on the Larsen ice shelf. This was a flat area laid down again 10,000 years ago, 700 feet thick. It was a perfect area for base and expedition off. And so this was 86. 2002, the Ward Hunt, which used to be right here, again disintegrated in the ocean. This is the last of the large ice shelves in the northern hemisphere. We were coming off of another expedition a year after that. We found this large chunk of the Ward Hunt ice shelf flowing out on the Arctic Ocean. Oops. And then we have the last tipping point is the ice shelves, or the ice caps. We have the Greenland ice cap, which is a large island. I'll show you a map in just a second here. It's about 1,800 miles across. It's 10,000 feet high, 10,400 feet This is on an expedition that we crossed in 88. This is along the 2 miles up, along the Greenland ice cap. The ice cap is, this is 1,800 miles from the top to the bottom. It holds about, the scientists think, around 10 to 12% of the world's fresh water. If the ice shelf destabilized and slipped into the ocean, we would have a sea level rise of about 24 feet. What this picture shows here, the Greenland, the red areas here, and this is 1992, this shows the summer thaws. The summer thaws in 92 were coming up to about 700 or 800 feet. This is 10 years later. You can almost visualize as the Arctic is getting warmer and warmer each year. You're getting a thawing level up to 3,500, almost 4,000 feet in 2002. And this is in 2005. You can see how that's accelerating, almost up to 7,000 feet. On this, looking back, you can visualize as the Arctic warms up each year, that warmer air is getting higher and higher. You can ask, okay, so what? What's happening now in the summertime is we're getting a tremendous amount of runoff. It was melted down on the glacier. 10,000 feet of ice is not going to melt down, but you have these great rivers that flow down, and the rivers flow to the bottom of the ice cap. When you have great glaciers at an angle going into the ocean, and you lubricate the bottom of the glacier with water from the melt, what happens? You get surging of the glaciers like this, collapsing into the ocean. You're reading about this now. I couldn't give you this presentation a year ago because I would be accused of scare tactics, but everything I'm showing you here, you're reading. It's in all the papers. We're reading about the surging of these glaciers in southwestern Greenland. Greenland itself, though, I don't want to give the impression Greenland is stable at this point, but that's why we have to make a really strong move right away on this, because if we continue business as usual, there's a very likelihood that this ice cap will become disabled, and that would disrupt everything. I want to take this on, and the Eskimo people, the Inuit, as they're called, had a conference on climate change 6 years ago in 2002. It was not followed by anybody, but they met within themselves, and the Canadian government sponsored it. It was up in Cambridge Bay. It was really a quite remarkable 90-page document that was put out. But I'm going to read you some from the Inuit, from the elders. These people are very wise. They don't speak our language. They have no idea what our culture is like. Materialism, the cars, they're almost like Stone Age people in a way. They live off the land, but they're extremely observant and very wise. And I'll just, as I give these quotes, I'll talk about the villages where they came from. Pelly Bay is in the eastern Canadian Arctic. I do not speak or write English, so I cannot say that I know what they talk about in regards to climate change. But the changes are there in our climate. The weather has changed. The patterns have shifted. This is from Iqaluit. 2 weeks from now, I'm traveling with three Inuit hunters from Iqaluit. Iqaluit is the cultural center of the Canadian Arctic. It's in an area close to Baffin Island on the North American continent where there's a very strong current. With that current, it's very rich in sea mammals. And that's the coldest place in North America. They, up until just a couple of years ago, they would normally have 40, 50 below 3, 4, or 5 months out of the year. This would freeze at where that current was, enable that culture to grow. They've been in this area for 8,000 years. Quote here, the seasons have definitely changed to a point where it is now unsafe to travel on the sea ice. In Iqaluit, a population of 960 in the last year and a half, they've lost 7 of their hunters because of thin ice. It's at a point now where the elders won't even go out hunting anymore on the ice. This is happening in all the villages. They all say the danger of their hunters. And it's not like just one family has a hunter. A hunter supports a whole group of people. And when you're considering 80% of their food comes from the hunting, this is a very serious thing when you're losing your wage earners here. Eastern Hudson Bay. The sea ice now is subject to different currents, which tear off large pieces of landfast ice, barring our path to and from our camps. Now, you can maybe see this on satellite photographs happening, but when you're on the ground, seeing these huge chunks of landfast ice breaking off, changing your life, you know something's up. This is Grease Fjord, southern Ellesmere Island. The ice is giving up timber, logs that have been held by the icy grip of glaciers for thousands and thousands of years. This is a statement of what's happening. We're always looking for that something that's going to show us that's really happening. This is fast melting. Pond Inlet, northern Baffin Island. I think that the calendars have been fast forward. The seasons have changed completely to the point where even the snow has been changed. Clyde River, this would be eastern Baffin Island. The glaciers in our mountains have steadily degressed to points where they're no longer perceivable by the naked eye. Pengerton, this is a village southern Baffin Island. There's been more and more traditionally unknown insects, wasps, birds, dragonflies, immigrating to our lands. Lucky for us, we have seen these animals on TV, or else we would not have known what these species are. Again, a Gluick. The winds have shifted. The snowdrifts run in different directions. In the last few years, the changes have been dramatic. This is Pawlatuck, north central Canadian Arctic. One issue that you're going to see very soon is we're starting to lose the pack, the snow, summer snowpack. We'll see this in the Rockies. It's going to be a massive problem in the Himalayas because there's probably close to 1 billion people that rely on the snowpack. The snowpack is important because when you have a large snowpack, it melts throughout the summer and it gives you irrigation, it gives you water. Part of our civilization has evolved around the snowpack. And, of course, the Arctic is always the early warning system for this. So this is a good example of that. The rivers, which used to run healthily throughout the summer, have now become very shallow in the summer, sometimes even drying up. We have noticed that the water levels are falling on all of our rivers. This is Broughton Island on the very traditional village on Baffin Island. The issue of forecasting weather based on thousands of years of observations have been thrown askew. And the matter of forecasting weather based on traditional knowledge no longer works in this day of age. This is Baker Lake, central Canadian Arctic. If you remember the story of Noah and his ark, we should be reminded that these people laughed at him until the day that the doors were closed and God let loose the floodwaters. Whale Cove, this would be western Hudson Bay. Our ancestors only carried light objects and they had no cargo carrying capacities, only their dogs and themselves. The only thing that they carried is what they needed for their survival. Because they carried only what they needed, it seems they lived a less stressful life. And another problem with global warming, you have carbon dioxide forming the atmosphere. As it gets warmer, it holds up more moisture in the air. And water vapor is the cause of more frequent storms, more stronger hurricanes. It's actually energy held in the atmosphere. The Inuit are very perceptive because I'll read what they say here. I would like to comment on what I have observed during clear days. It used to be a deep light blue sky as far as the eye could see. I'm wondering if a scientist could answer why the sky has changed its hue and color on the calm, clear days of spring. I believe that it's pollution of cars, trucks, snowmobiles, and power plants that affected the hue and the color of the sky. It's like humans are introducing their own dirty atmosphere by poisoning the air. Although the sky seems endless, the countless humans emitting pollution in small doses everywhere is affecting the sky. And I'll do a few more here. One major issue up there, aside from global warming, is called transboundary pollution. And these are PCBs, aerosols, light aerosols from fertilizers, pesticides, and so forth. At this latitude, because of the strong radiation, they're broken down, and they don't rain down on us. But the returning air currents, most of our air currents return in the Arctic. They then go down, these poisons, aerosols, go down into the food chain, and because it's so cold, they don't disintegrate. And they go immediately into the one-cell animals, and then since it's a tight food chain, it goes to the seals, and to the bears, and to the people. The breast, for example, in the eastern Hudson Bay, PCB level in mother's breast milk is 8 times higher than Ottawa. Transboundary pollution is a major problem for over 20 years. Again, because nobody knows about the Arctic and this has been going on, but these people are. I just have a few more quotes here I need to read to you about transboundary pollution, and then I'll just conclude here. We should research the cause and effects of these pollutants because we are the ones that are paying for other countries. Other countries' mistakes with our lives. It was very rare to see any kind of cancer in a youth. It has been only the last 20 years or so that cancer has ravaged our people. If we are to trace the pollutants back to the proper sources and the guilty parties in the United States, can they cut back their pollutants? Have the scientists presented their findings to the right people? And how? Read just the last question here. This is from my friend Theo from Gulick. The question we should be asking ourselves include, what will we do next? I think that's what we're here for. And how will we adapt and survive? I just want to conclude by some of the presentations that I've given around the state. The last year and a half, I've gave over 200 presentations, talked to tens of thousands of people, many different venues. I mean, anywhere, wherever I could get an audience, I spoke, basically. And I just want to show you some of the towns, cities and so forth. Apple Valley, for example, we're working with the School for Environmental Studies, known as the Zoo School. Actually, some of their students are coming up with us here in a couple days. Bemidji, we presented at the Paul Bunyan Theater up there. We had to a packed audience. We spent a whole weekend giving many presentations to the university. Bloomington, assisted living, we gave a number of the churches, Rotary Clubs, Brainerd, Minnesota, just was there on Thursday. The state tourism was up there, about 400 people. We spoke there. Jay and I gave a presentation in April to the whole community. We had over 1,000 people that came out. And it's not, I used to draw a smaller type crowd on expeditions. People are coming out because of global warming. These are people from all walks of life, different types of people, different sides of the aisle, conservatives, Republicans, everybody. And they're all very concerned, and they want to learn more. What can we do? Duluth, Minnesota, mayor there, we were up there when he, mayor signed the Climate Protection Act for the city. Egan, Minnesota, Eden Prairie, we talked to over 1,000 people, packed house at St. Andrew's Church out there. Also Pax Christi, the Catholic Church, we had over 1,000 people. We at Pax Christi, we drew in Catholics from 70 different parishes. And we initiated the Global Warming Action Team at that point. Our Archbishop talked about that. That action team is really rolling good standings right now. Elk River, Ely, Minnesota, my hometown, the community of Forest Lake, Grand Rapids, Minnesota. We spoke to the steel unions. We had a forum. All these were forums where we'd bring in a scientist, clergy, discuss, you know, what our government is about. Grand Rapids with the steel union, they're very concerned. They want to capture that market for the wind turbine industry. They want manufacturing of wind turbines in this country, in the state particularly. So we were all around the range, Hibbing and so forth. Lake City, school systems. I've given talks to all school levels, colleges, all the way up. Lakeville, the teachers' associations. We talked to all the Minnesota state conventions today, this year. National conventions for the environmental teachers' educations. And then out in Maitamita, in my hometown, right across from my grandparents' house, St. Andrew's Church, we had about 1,000 people, full house again, all around. Maplewood, Maple Grove, Mendota Heights, Minneapolis. We did many small groups. Linden Hills has formed an effort called the Linden Hills Power and Light. They're going to get a methane digester for their garbage. But all sorts of small groups, activists, if you want to call them that, in Minneapolis, and churches and Rotary Clubs. Morris, Minnesota, talked to the colleges, talked to many colleges. In fact, you're going to see a lot of movement and action in the colleges. I would predict on this coming up election year in 2 years, you're going to see 50% of the young people coming out. They're very easy to mobilize. They're connected on the Internet. They're energized. They just need a little bit of a push and an example. Northfield, Minnesota, again, a packed audience at one of the congregations. Red Wing, the Chamber of Commerce, Rochester, St. Paul, Minnesota. We did all sorts of presentations in our capital here. Press from right wing to liberal to middle line to whatever press we could get on. We talked about global warming, got the discussion going. Shoreview, Wilmer, the farms. We did all the farm, as many farm city towns in the southwestern United States. And boy, they're under this real big time. It's really great to see these communities that we're really struggling financially now, the economic boom of ethanol, and so we drive that into cellulose space. And Winona did the Frozen Rivers Film Festival 2 days ago down there, packed house. In fact, we went to the coffee house the next morning. We poured in 125 on that over coffee. Woodbury, City Woodbury, we jammed the audience. So you can see that, you know, we have to act on this. We have the populace is demanding it, wants action. This is for anybody that's an elected official now, golden opportunity to take some action on this. But above all, we really need to make some realistic steps on this. We need rules and regulations that are going to be great for our economy, but real steps, not just paperwork and discussion, discussion, discussion. We can't wait on this. We used to say we had 10 years. Well, 10 years was a year and 2 months ago. We have nine months or so right now. So I just want to encourage everybody that this is really a win-win. We're not going to lose anything. This is an opportunity here. We have to really discuss, put down our differences and figure out how we can do this, because it's going to be the best direction that we can go. So I want to thank everybody for having me here. Thank you.
University system. As Minnesotans, we can take great pride in the contributions they have made to the science of global warming. I am so pleased to be able to be here so that I, along with you, can understand the challenges of global warming and what we can do about it. Our first presenter is Dr. David Tillman, Regents Professor and McKnight Presidential University Chair of Ecology at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Tillman is well known, not just in the state of Minnesota, but nationally and internationally. He had a paper that in the last issue of Science was on the cover. Welcome, Dr. Tillman. We are so glad you're here.
Thank you, Representative McGinnis, Madam Speaker, Senators and Representatives. I'm honored to be here. I was sitting here thinking that you are probably one of my most attentive audience students and maybe one of my most important. My talk may be appearing here shortly. Have you found the talk on my memory stick, at least? There we go. I want to first briefly review some of the science involved in the climate change, the global warming, and then go to what I think the real issue is, how we can find solutions, and share with you what I would assert is a summary of some of the best minds addressing this question around the world. So on the science of climate change, as Will pointed out Climate Change 101, or Global Warming 101, this is Global Warming 102, I guess, Will. The Earth is warmed by solar radiation. And when this radiation hits the Earth's surface and is absorbed, some of it is back radiated as long wave radiation toward outer space. Carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and other greenhouse gases absorb this long wave radiation and hold the heat in the atmosphere. The temperature of the Earth is basically controlled by the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and the major greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide. So let's quickly look at what's called the carbon cycle. Carbon occurs in a variety of forms on Earth. A major form, the form in the atmosphere, is basically carbon dioxide, carbon with two oxygens. It's an invisible gas. There are 750 gigatons of it. In the atmosphere. Plants take up this gas. The carbon in the plants ends up being 40% of the dry weight of plant material. So carbon that had been carbon dioxide is taken up by plants. It's turned into sugars and cellulose and other compounds, proteins and so on, and makes up 40% of the dry weight of plant material. So there's a lot of exchange from the atmosphere through the plants and their uptake. And plant uptake of carbon dioxide, when you burn this fuel, for instance, make a biofuel, the carbon that gets released was a carbon that had been taken up. There's no net effect on the atmosphere. Now, plants die and turn over, and when they shed their leaves and branches and roots, the carbon in them builds up in the soil. The second largest storehouse of biologically active carbon in the world is in the soils of the world. What happens to these soils has a huge impact on the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. In fact, if you look at the last 100 years of all the carbon dioxide that has been released into the atmosphere, 60% of it has come from the burning of fossil fuels. 40% of it has come from how the lands on Earth have been managed, if you will, from farming land and clear-cutting forests and burning them and so on. And there's actually an opportunity we have here, as I'll talk about later, to have a benefit from how we manage the ecosystems of Minnesota to increase their ability to remove and store what had been carbon dioxide in the air, to store it basically as soil, as well as living plant biomass, as one of the approaches to ameliorate the problem. The problem that we're talking about is from fossil fuel combustion. When we take these organic fuels that were produced by life millions and millions of years ago and combust them, we release back to the atmosphere the carbon dioxide they had. And in doing so, we are causing carbon dioxide levels to go ever higher. So here's some graphs showing you what's happening. I apologize, these are sort of small for the back of the room. This shows carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere from year 1000 to the year 2000. It was very, very flat before industrialization. With the burning of coal and then oil and so on, the level of carbon dioxide has shot up dramatically. If you will, an exponential increase. The same is true for all of the other greenhouse gases, nitrous oxide, methane, and then sulfates, which also influence global climate. They all have shot up because of modern industrial practices and their impacts. So you can see where we are now. This is what's happened in the last 1,000 years. I'd like to show you the last 400,000 years. Now you might wonder, how do we know how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere 400,000 years ago? Well, you can go to lakes which have very deep ice on them. You go to the Antarctic, go to Lake Vostok. It has a mile and a half of ice on it. That ice is formed as snow has come to the soil surface. The snow traps in it little pockets of air. It gets compressed to the next layer of snow, the next layer of snow, the next layer of snow, year after year after year. You have pockets of air. You can sample. When you take a drilling rig and take about a 6-inch core of ice going down a mile and a half, you can measure how much carbon dioxide there's been in the Earth's atmosphere, not quite year by year, but at least decade by decade, for the last 400,000 years. When you do that, you see this upper green line here. That's as high as a level of this greenhouse gas as we've ever experienced up to modern times until the Industrial Revolution and the burning of fossil fuel. And from that point till now, we have shot carbon dioxide levels up to here, higher than they've ever been in the last 400,000 years. More of this greenhouse gas and its associated warming. And if we keep doing what we're doing, by the end of the century, we're going to be up here. Massively, massively beyond where we have ever been in the last 400,000 years of life on Earth, creating a condition that is totally unprecedented, and a rate of change of climate that has never before been experienced by the Earth or by us. So what does this level of carbon dioxide predict? There are thousands of people who spend their lives doing models of global climate. And some of the very best groups, one group is called the Hadley Group, is in England. I'm showing you their results. But the consensus among a large number of people who do this global climate modeling, and these models are incredible feats of physics, of mathematics, of air absorbing and water absorbing heat and how it moves around, of all the basic principles of physics, so on, are built in these models, these huge, massive models that allow estimation of where we're going. And they're tested by seeing how well they predict things that have happened in the past. And these models predict this. Here's the forecast for the period from around 2090, from 2070 to 2100. So about 80 or so years, a lifetime, I would hope for many of us, not for me, but for a newborn person in the future. Here's a forecast for the mean annual temperature, the average of every daily high and low. That orange means we're going to be 5 to 10 degrees warmer Celsius. Let me put it in English. That's 9 degrees Fahrenheit is the lower level. And I think a reasonable upper bound is going up about 7. The normal guess here is that we're going to be about 7 degrees warmer Celsius. That's 13 degrees warmer on the average day in Minnesota than we are right now. 13 degrees Fahrenheit warmer. And the sun, that's year-round, and you can see there's warming across much of all of the United States and southern Canada of that same level in the predicted for the summers at that time. But what does this imply? Well, I I take a certain site in Minnesota very personally. It's called Cedar Creek Natural History Area. I do my research there. And here are mean annual temperatures from 1940 to about the present time. Every dot here is the average temperature of a year. You can see some years are fairly cool. Some years are a lot warmer. In fact, the warmest year at our site, it was 1988. It was the worst drought Minnesota has experienced in the last century. A very severe drought. Corn yields around the state were down 50%. That is showing what happened in 1988. That dot, if you will, is a real dot. What I've taken is the pattern, the normal year-to-year variation we see right now, and added on to it the lowest estimate that we have, a 9-degree Fahrenheit warming for Minnesota. Let you see what it might look like from 2070 to 2100, the points up here. And look at this. This hot year, the biggest drought of the last century, only has 2 years by the time you get to the year 2070 that are as cool as it. Many, many years are going to be much, much warmer than the hottest thing any of us have ever experienced in our lifetime. That was temperature. Temperature affects water availability. These models don't predict that rainfall is going to change very much. But the amount of soil moisture available for a plant to grow, whether it's a corn plant or a prairie producing bioenergy or forest, depends not only how much rain there is, it depends on how warm it is. Warmer temperatures lead to faster evaporation of water from the soil and through the plants and into the air. And these models predict, because of this warming, that we're going to have, across this part of North America, which includes Minnesota, we're going to have major soil moisture deficits happening throughout. This is the summer, and I didn't show it on here, but the same thing is predicted for autumns. So we're predicted, because of this much warmer summer temperatures and the same rainfall, to have much more common droughts, having severe soil moisture deficits in ways we don't see them at all right now. So not only a warmer world, but functionally, in terms of how the vegetation of the earth that we depend on to produce our food and our forest products and so on, a world that will be much, much drier, having serious impacts on productivity. Now, I want to make a point. It reminds me of the Christmas carol. Is this the way the world will be or might be? Well, at some point in time, society is going to take action that will stop this from happening. The real issue is when that's going to happen. This shows you what the world will be like, and the bottom color code here is a temperature warming, in this case in degrees Fahrenheit, if we go to double pre-industrial CO2 levels. We're not there yet, but we're getting close. This is what the world will be like. We have lots of these temperatures that are 20 or so degrees warmer across here by that color. If we go to 4 times CO2 levels, which would be where we'll be shortly into the next century if we don't do anything about greenhouse gases. So there are big changes. It's not just that we get, at our current level of greenhouse gases, we're going to have the problem I showed you. The more greenhouse gases we have, the warmer the world will become and the greater these changes will be. So I would like to note that this, what I'm telling you, is the result of a consensus among a very large number of scientists. And it's also become a consensus among many people in the business community. You may have noticed in a Wall Street Journal, the headline was, "In Climate Controversy, Industry Cedes Ground." Industries like British Petroleum, Duke Energy, which is the largest burner of coal in the United States, Duke Energy, General Electric, Caterpillar, DuPont, and others came out expressing public support for efforts to slow down greenhouse gas emission by the United States. So, in that spirit, I would like to show you what many scientists who think about this view to be a workable solution. By workable solution, it's a solution which we have current technology, which if we apply it, can actually be used to stop this predicted ramp up in carbon release to the atmosphere and carbon dioxide release. Here's where we are right now in terms of how much CO2 has been released in the air. Here's a simple sort of linear projection as to where we might be various times into the future. The issue is this. If we can get rid of further increases in release of CO2, we can have the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere level off. Right now, we're having carbon dioxide go up and up and up. In fact, it's going up, as I showed you, exponentially. If we can stabilize emissions to at current levels will be able to have the Earth's atmosphere have its carbon dioxide levels stabilized. It won't be instant, but it will stabilize, and once it stabilizes, we will not have any further global warming occurring. So let me show you what it takes. This is a paper by... I have to point this better. Oops, pointed too well. Paper by Steve Pakala and Rob Sokolow at Princeton University that came out in the Journal of Science about a year ago. They said, well, that what we need to do is to decrease emissions of carbon so that we basically get rid of that triangle. This triangle shows an amount of carbon dioxide in billions of tons of release per year. And if you look at this, there are these wedges here. They said, well, this whole getting rid of that whole triangle with any one technology is very unlikely to be possible. They said, let's sort of divide this up into easier pieces. Let's look at this. Here we have a certain amount of CO2 release rate right now. We're trying to keep CO2 release at today's level instead of having it go up. So let's look at one of these wedges. This wedge here, this triangular wedge, shows an ability to slow the increased rate of release of carbon dioxide from what it is now to what it might be, such that between now and 50 years from now, the world would have, for each slice, one less gigaton of carbon released into the air as carbon dioxide. So we have to find seven ways that will allow us, ramping up slowly from where we are now to 50 years from now, seven ways, each of which can get rid of a gigaton of carbon being released to the atmosphere. Well, when they looked at existing technologies, they actually found 15 different technologies, for which they made a case in the journal Science that offered each of them 15 different wedges, if you will. Technology with 15 different wedges. So, for instance, energy efficiency. We all know that our society could achieve everything we're achieving now with less energy if we were dedicating effort to efficiency. And they estimated that three of the seven wedges could be gained by increased efficiency. Renewables, they estimated that four of the wedges of reduction that need to be had for the world could be gained by renewables. Three and four is seven. That would solve the whole problem. But, in fact, you can also do it by increasing natural sinks, by having soils and forests, if you will, prairie soils and forest soils, be managed in a way which increases their ability to sequester carbon. You can take coal, gasify it, and get energy from it, and then store, this is a carbon sequestration here, store that carbon in the ground, and these approaches can get rid of another two wedges of carbon. And finally, I think that says, I can't see my thing, you can use nuclear energy as opposed to coal as a way to generate electricity and get rid of another two wedges. There's sort of this smorgasbord of possible solutions. We only need to come up with seven of them, if you will, that work, to meet this goal of stabilizing global carbon dioxide emissions so that we can stabilize this increase in global climate. Well, let's look at some of these, and some of these I think which are in the grasp of Minnesotans. Efficiency in transport. Worldwide, we need to have a wedge merely out of transportation. We need to either have basically the majority of the cars on the world, 2 billion cars, burn gasoline and diesel, get 60 miles a gallon versus 30. They don't have to get 60 tomorrow. They have to go from getting 30 now to getting 60 50 years from now. We have to ramp up fuel efficiency in transportation. Or public transportation, if we had mass transit, it's within the scenarios that have been played out, it's very easy for mass transit to give us a wedge of reduction of carbon dioxide. And in doing so, it would eliminate the need for people to have or to use about a billion vehicles. Oops. Energy in buildings. I didn't realize this until I started working with an architect named John Carmody. About a third of all the energy used in the United States and around the world is used in buildings. And standards for energy efficiency in buildings could reduce that greatly. And in fact, the projections are we can easily get at least one wedge worldwide by increasing efficiency in the design of buildings. Insulation, easy and cheap. Frankly, standards could be a lot higher than they are right now. Efficient heating. More fuel-efficient furnaces in the long term actually save homeowners money, but they cost you more upfront, which is why they're not done as much as they should. Cooling is another major cost. Appliances in houses use a lot of electricity. Lighting is a major use of electricity. There are ways to use natural lighting, fluorescent bulbs, and so on that can greatly reduce energy need for that. Maybe we all don't need to live in McMansions. So there are a wide variety of ways that by encouraging energy-efficient buildings, we can address the problems that we face. Renewable energy is another major thing. There are a variety of calculations that suggest that the Midwest states could, with the deployment of enough windmills placed in the right places across the landscape, produce all the electric energy we need for the whole nation. Now, there's some problems to not produce all the time we need it. There's some work to be done on that. But renewable energy from wind can be a major factor in helping us and could provide, if you will, one wedge of the solution that we have. I'll talk a little bit more about the things I know and love personally, so bear with me, sorry. The door's already locked, so we're in good shape. We can't escape. So renewable energy produced on degraded lands. There's lots of land that has been farmed that is no longer used for farming, that has been cleared of forest and is not really being used productively, that can be dedicated to producing biofuels. And in doing that, not just in Minnesota, but around the world, this is some of the things we had in our science paper, this land, this degraded land, which therefore does not compete with agricultural production, can provide two of the seven wedges that we need. Let me quickly show you how this happens. It happens if you use this degraded land by restoring a lot of its original biological diversity. What we showed in our paper in Science is that more diverse ecosystems, and here this was more diverse prairie ecosystems, produce much more energy than monocultures. Here's actually our average of all of our switchgrass monocultures. It's a good species, right there at the average of what single prairie species do when you're growing them. But its production was greatly exceeded. High diversity mixtures of native prairie plants produced 238% more energy per year than did switchgrass or the average of all of the other species we grew in monoculture. And that's not to knock switchgrass. I should point out switchgrass is a big improvement over corn as a way to produce renewable energy. Perennial crops provide a large number of ecosystem services that are valuable to us. Just that we were very surprised when we did this work to find out how much better these high-diversity mixtures were. There's something else that goes on. I mentioned carbon dioxide in the air, taken up by plants, and from the plants in prairie, about two-thirds to three-fourths of that ends up going to their roots. Prairie plants have deep root systems. That's how sod houses were built. The roots held the soil together. These deep root systems that go down to about 2 meters or so have a lot of carbon coming into them. It was taken out of the atmosphere, and organic carbon into the soil. And some of these roots get shed and so on. And through time, these decaying roots build up the deep, rich soils that we had in our prairie that are the source of the Midwest being the breadbasket of the nation. Well, our research shows that these soils accumulate carbon through time. They remove CO2 from the air and they store it as organic matter in the soil in a way that can provide at least another one of these wedges for the nation. And here's just some data showing that. And what I want to really talk about is written on the side from the air, and they store it as organic matter in the soil in a way that can provide at least another one of these wedges for the nation. And here's just some data showing that. And what I want to really talk about is written on the side here. We did not expect this. When we did this calculation, we were completely amazed about this. We measured how much carbon dioxide was removed from the air and stored in these soils I maybe should talk about the unit shown here, but 4.4 tons per hectare is about 1.8 or 2 U.S. tons per acre. So you want to see about 2 tons per acre of carbon dioxide taken from the air, stored in the soil every year by these diverse mixtures of prairie. If you ask how much fossil energy do you release to plant the prairie, which you only do once, it's a perennial ecosystem that lasts basically forever when you mow it for hay. How much does it take to plant it, to harvest it, to haul it, to be processed into energy? That releases about 0.3 or so here. I can't see my slide. About 0.3 tons of CO2 per hectare per year, leaving a net decrease in atmospheric CO2 of about 4 tons
of CO2 per hectare per year, or about 1.8 U.S. tons per acre per year, that's no longer in the air. It doesn't matter what you do with the above-ground biomass. You can burn it, you can turn it into any kind of energy source you want. That will have no net effect, because the carbon in that above-ground biomass was taken out of the air as CO2. It's in the biomass now. When you burn it, it goes back in the air. It cycles back and forth. The big picture is you have the storage below ground, and what that means is that any fuel you make from that above-ground biomass is going to be carbon negative. When you're done burning that fuel, there's going to be less carbon dioxide in the air than there was before. And I anticipate a question or two about that. So, carbon-negative biofuels you can make, not just carbon-neutral fuels, which have no effect on atmospheric greenhouse gases, but carbon-negative biofuels. What can you do with this biomass? Well, you can mix it with coal in fluidized bed coal electric-generating facilities, up to about 10 or so percent. And that renewable energy can provide a portion of otherwise coal-driven energy, which is now renewable. It displaces how much CO2 you would have burned from the coal, having no effect there, neutralizing well that CO2. Plus, there's CO2 stored in the prairie that forgives it. So putting 10% biomass in basically gets rid of 20% of the greenhouse effect of electric energy when this modification is made to it. You can turn it by making ethanol out of the cellulose in it. You can turn it into ethanol and have that be a biofuel. This is, if you will, the next step, the cellulosic ethanol after corn ethanol. You can gasify it. Basically, you heat it up, you break that biomass apart into carbon monoxide and hydrogen. You can combine those together and make gasoline out of them, diesel fuel, dimethyl ether, methyl alcohol, anything you want. Or you can make electricity or do both. And all of these fuels, when you make them, when you're done burning these fuels, you'll have less carbon dioxide in the air than before because you've used the carbon sequestration that's going on in those prairie soils. So how much energy can you get? This shows the actual net energy gain from making corn grain ethanol. This is per hectare. And sorry, this is for scientists. It's megajoules. That's about 80 gallons of true net energy gain of ethanol per acre. You get 400 gallons of ethanol per acre. Only 80 gallons are new energy. The rest was fossil energy that was used to farm it, to make the fertilizer, and to run the ethanol plant. Now, if the ethanol plant runs on renewable energy, I'll show you, it's a whole different story. That's much better. But that's how much you get. And here's what you get if you look at soybean production. This is biodiesel. Here, these are all done in fertile soils. Here's what happens if you use degraded land. In fact, our research site is in on the Anoka Sand Plain, on very poor Anoka Sand Plain soils, very degraded lands. And here's how much energy you can get if you burn it and get electricity. Basically equal to what you can get from corn on fertile land. Here's what happens if you turn it into ethanol. By cellulosic ethanol. Here's what happens if you gasify it. Gasification has some advantages. It gives you more net energy gain. But here's the second part of it. Here's the change in how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere. Compared to burning gasoline, corn ethanol reduces atmospheric CO2 a little bit. Compared to burning diesel fuel, soybean reduces atmospheric CO2 a bit. But when you take this prairie biomass with all the carbon that's been stored in the soil and burn these, you have carbon-negative fuels. You actually have less CO2 in the air than afterwards. But here, when you add in how much you would have burned, let's say, of coal to make electricity, here's the greenhouse gas savings you have for the same thing for making ethanol or making synthetic fuels. Huge greenhouse gas savings compared to what you would have had you just used the current fossil fuel. So I want to make one last point. I think ethanol from corn, which you have supported over the years, is a very important development. Ethanol from corn has proven to us that we can make viable biofuels, which can have a significant impact on our society. The same is true for biodiesel. In analyzing ethanol and biodiesel, we were asking, how can we do things better? How can we improve on them? We want to have these fuels get better and better through time. One way to improve in the short term on corn ethanol, well, it is still the major way that we have to make ethanol, is to substitute this orange bar here is how much fossil energy, normal natural gas, is burned in an ethanol plant. Here's how much energy is used on the farm. Here's the actual energy content in green of ethanol. There's not much of a gain there. The gain comes when you include the energy credit for distiller dry grain, about a 25% gain. If you get rid of all the fossil energy that is used here to run that ethanol plant and replace it with bioenergy, such as the energy from prairie biomass, you suddenly have a whole different story. Instead of having a 25% gain on your fossil investment from corn ethanol, you now have 189% gain. Here's your fossil input. Here's the amount of new non-fossil energy you're coming out of an ethanol plant. Instead of having 80 gallons of non-fossil effective energy gain from current methods, most current sites, not all, there's some ones that are doing this already, which is a very good practice. Instead of having 80 gallons gain, we get 262 gallons of real ethanol energy gain to society. And because you're using this prairie biomass that stores carbon, this fuel is in fact carbon neutral. You neutralize all the releases of carbon dioxide that occurred on the farm and in making fertilizer and so on by the carbon stored in those prairie soils. They balance each other off. This is carbon neutral. Well, what does it take? If you do this on our very degraded lands on the Anoka Sand Plain, it takes about 3/4 of an acre of prairie to give you the energy to take all the corn from an acre of land and make it into ethanol and to, if you will, remove all the carbon dioxide that was released in producing this corn and all the fertilizer and so on that went into the process, to remove that carbon and store it in the soil. So this combination of corn and prairie can actually give us these carbon neutral fuels that have a much greater net energy gain for society. So I want to stop and close by making a few comments here. First, there are a large number of existing technologies which we can apply to solve global warming. The problem is not in our lack of knowledge, lack of ways to solve the problem. Frankly, the problem is in having the will to address it. I'm delighted by this meeting because I think that you have the will to address this. It's also very clear that the sooner that we actually implement solutions to this problem, the lower the problem is going to be. I would assert, with what we know now, the time to implement solutions is now. Now, I showed you these ramps. We don't need to have solutions to get rid of the amount we need to remove in the year 2050. We don't need those 7 different 1-gigaton solutions right now if our goal is to stabilize atmospheric CO2. What we need is to implement solutions that can grow through time, that can ramp up through time, such that 50 years from now, those solutions, each one of those 7 solutions, would be each removing 1 gigaton of carbon per year from the release in the atmosphere. So it is not that we have to, if you will, reverse our lifestyle of the last 150 years of the Industrial Revolution right now. We can stabilize climate where we are now by stabilizing emissions as we are now. That may not be the long-term best ideal solution. We might learn as time goes on, we'd like to help reverse some of the increased CO2 we've already had. But I would assert the least we can do if we want to address the problem we face right now is stabilize emissions right now. And that is doable by ramping up various solutions, the ones I've been talking about. To do this in Minnesota, the most relevant things that we can do as a people, as a state, renewable energy, energy efficiency in all of its forms, and carbon sequestration by increasing our dedication to wisely managing our grasslands and our forest ecosystem. Any delay that we have clearly harms our ability to solve these problems. As the bishop and the archbishop said, I share with them the very strong conviction that delay is unwise and unethical. Thank you.
It's my honor to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Lucinda Johnson. Dr. Johnson is an associate center director at the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, where she's worked for almost 20 years. She was recently appointed as a founding fellow to the University of Minnesota's newly established Institute on the Environment. Dr. Johnson received her PhD at Michigan State University in 1999. And as an aquatic and landscape ecologist, her research is focused on understanding the interactions between terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems and the impacts of human activities on humans and biota. In 2001, she was asked to participate as one of 13 authors of a report on climate change impacts to the Great Lakes region. Today, her presentation will focus on water and agricultural impacts of global warming for Minnesota. Dr. Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Hilty and Madam Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, it's truly an honor to be here. I just am overwhelmed by your presence and attention to this cause. Today I'd like to talk a little bit about the impacts of global climate change on aquatic resources and agriculture. And I'm going to just present a few snapshots of some of the impacts that are expected. Obviously, this is a quite complicated issue, and there are lots of impacts that we can expect on our environment, but we'll just be covering a few of those today. As many of you have seen in the newspapers, 2006 was the warmest year on record for the U.S. and the sixth warmest for the world. In fact, the average temperature was more than 2 degrees warmer than average over the last 100 years. Well, here in Minnesota, the evidence of climate change over the last century has been mounting. We've seen increases of 2.5 degrees, more than 2.5 degrees temperatures over the winter, with increases of about 1 degree over the last century during the summertime. Accompanying those increases in temperature are declining days of ice cover and thickness of ice cover on our lakes. As Minnesotans, we spend a lot of time outdoors during the winter, and this obviously has a huge impact on us in terms of not only our ability to recreate outside, but those who generate income as a result of winter activities are suffering as a result of this. Another trend is the increase in the number and severity of intense storm events over the last century. In fact, since the 30s, we've seen a 100% increase in intense storm events, and that has generated, it's been variable across the state of Minnesota, with most of those changes occurring in the northern part of the state and the far south. So when we talk about what might happen in the future, as Dr. Tillman mentioned, there are some very good models which have been used to forecast climate change into the future for Minnesota and the Great Lakes region. Similar to the models that Dr. Tillman talked about, the forecast for the state of Minnesota is 6 to 10 degree increases in wintertime temperatures by the end of the century, and 7 to 16 degree Fahrenheit temperatures during the summer by the end of the century. That, of course, translates into a fairly long increase in our growing season. Now, the planning horizon for most of the agencies is around 50 years. So you can see that if we look at the changes that are anticipated at the end of 50 years, those don't begin to reflect the potential changes towards the end of the century. So it suggests that we need to be thinking longer than the planning horizon for many of our current agency findings. Another prediction is that along with the doubling that we've already seen in intense rain events, is that we'll see another doubling in intense rain events by the end of the century. And I'm not going to talk about the predictions for soil moisture and precipitation, because those tend to have a little bit more variability and uncertainty associated with them. Those three factors, that is the increase in temperature, the increased intensity and frequency of storm events, are the factors that we have very, very high levels of certainty for in all of the models that are run. So what does this translate for in terms of what happens to climate for the state of Minnesota? Those models suggest that our summer times are going to look like Kansas, more humid, much hotter, and much more uncomfortable. I grew up in Puerto Rico, and trust me, Kansas seems pretty nice in comparison to some of those tropical temperatures. And one of the reasons I moved to Minnesota was to avoid those, in fact. Wintertime temperatures and conditions will look more like northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin, more ice and a lot less cold temperatures or lower temperatures in the wintertime. So some of the impacts that this translates into involve changes across all of our ecosystems and our societal values, our infrastructure, and our both wildlife and human health. But the thing I want to remind everyone is that these changes are not going to occur in a vacuum. They're superimposed on top of already difficult conditions with respect to the way that our natural resources are being utilized, the condition of the air and water. So climate change problems will be superimposed on top of these existing problems. So specifically, warmer winters are predicted and are resulting in reduced duration of ice cover, as well as the thickness of ice. So we're seeing reduced income from winter recreation. Because the lakes have open water for a longer period of time, they're experiencing more evaporation and therefore lower water levels. And these longer growing seasons are resulting in more productivity and more growth of weeds in our lake. Earlier snowmelt can have the potential to disrupt some species of fish breeding. And lake stratification, which is that process which separates the warmer top waters in lakes from the very cold bottom waters and is very fundamental to the normal functioning of lakes, the earlier onset of lake stratification is anticipated to result in lower oxygen levels in the bottom, cooler parts of the lake, which result in fish kills and all kinds of chemical processes which move nutrients and contaminants out of the sediment and into the overlying water column. And once those lakes turn over and become mixed again, those nutrients and contaminants move up and circulate throughout the water column. The warmer summer temperatures are anticipated to cause a great deal of difficulty for fish species in particular, those species which are adapted to cold water temperatures. This is a graph of fish species arrayed along a continuum of their preferred temperature ranges. And if you are a walleye fisherman or a bass fisherman, you can anticipate having more habitat for those fish and greater availability of those species. But if, like my husband and I, who are brook trout fishermen, we prefer these cold water species, and there is an anticipated prediction of a loss of up to 75% of the cold water fish habitat in the more productive lakes and about 60 to 70% loss in the more clean lakes. Very dramatic changes anticipated. So the overall impact on fish communities is a loss of that cold water habitat, an expansion in the range of some undesirable species such as Asian carp and zebra mussels. The intense rain events and storm events that are anticipated are anticipated to cause problems for eggs and fry of fish in streams because of these increased flow. And because of these a number of different conditions, we're anticipating increased stress due to degraded water quality. Well, Dr. Tillman talked about how we're anticipating drier conditions in some of the model forecasts. One of the problematic things with predicting climate is that, in fact, one of the things that we're very sure of is that there will be huge amounts of variability in future climates. So we'll be seeing greater incidence of droughts as well as greater incidence of flooding, primarily as a result of these intense storm events, probably occurring in the spring when the soils are still frozen. So you have these very large rain events occurring when soils are frozen. That means that all of the water is running off into streams, and that increases the potential for floods during the spring. Well, when you take into account the effect of urbanization and increased impervious surface, you take into account the loss of wetland, the increase in tile drainage and channelization in streams, those floods could be exacerbated or even higher and more intense than they have been. The results are increased soil erosion, which is very harmful to farm systems, and degraded water quality, both of which have huge economic impacts. We've had lots of weather events in the past century that have resulted in more than $1 billion, but in from 1980 to 2006, there were something like 76 of these billion-dollar weather events occurring across the United States, some of which were right here in the upper Midwest with the 1997 and 1993 floods. So why would water quality be degraded under these conditions? First, we have these intense storm events, and next we have these increased and elevated temperatures. Well, the increased storm activity, of course, increases soil erosion and therefore runoff, which brings with it contaminants, nutrients, and sediments. These higher temperatures cause algal to grow, and that actually depletes dissolved oxygen, which degrades water quality and causes all kinds of fish kills. And as I mentioned before, one thing we are certain of is that there will be increased variability in flow regimes. So this tension between droughts and flooding is going to be a thing of the future. This is a plot of a sensor that we have in a stream up in Duluth. It's a small urban stream called Tisher Creek. This slug here is of sediments as they go running into the stream as a result of this very abrupt rain event that occurred. When you combine those kinds of sediments in streams with fish, the prevailing condition for fish is very harmful, and if the turbid conditions last for a long time, they can ultimately result in death of the fish. Well, what would be the impacts on our agricultural systems? Of course, carbon dioxide is a fertilizer, so we're anticipating that there would be increased productivity as a result of this fertilization from carbon dioxide. And accompanying with warmer temperatures and longer growing season, you would expect greater productivity. However, the productivity due to the increase in carbon dioxide has been shown experimentally to be offset. In fact, the increase in fertilization has been completely negated by the increases in ozone concentrations. So ozone is a poison, and any benefit that we're anticipating from carbon dioxide is likely to be offset by the increased ozone concentrations. But take into account the fact that there'll be increased extreme storm events with hail and damaging rains, and also extreme heat events and possibly droughts. This could completely offset the benefits that might accrue as a result of these changing climates. The other thing I'd like to remind you is that even though the climate might become warmer, there's no way we're going to be growing corn on the shores of Lake Superior because the soils up there are just not suitable for those kinds of farming practices and crops. So livestock and health and humans obviously are going to have a difficult time with these warmer temperatures. The predictions are that there'll be more than 40 days exceeding 90 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century, and 10 to 25 days exceeding 97 degrees Fahrenheit. I think there were something like 125 deaths last summer resulting from the heat wave in California. I don't know what the numbers were for Minnesota, but this is the kind of thing that's anticipated for the future. For livestock, these increased temperatures, the extreme temperatures, result in reduced appetite and therefore reduced weight gain and also reduced milk production. And on top of all of this, we have the added detriment of having increased the attractiveness of habitat and the climate for some of our disease vectors, such as Lyme disease, West Nile virus, and Cryptosporidium, which was the bug which infected the water supply in Milwaukee. So I want to leave you with this message that the worst, the impacts of climate change are not inevitable, but we have to take into account the things that Dr. Tillman and others have mentioned. We need to reduce emissions, we need to minimize pressure on our environment, and we need to plan and prepare for the impacts of climate change which are already occurring. Even if we were to turn off the spigot today, there is still going to be a residual amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere which will account for warming into the future. So the sources of energy, as Dr. Tillman suggested, are quite varied. We get about a third each in terms of transportation, electric generation, and heating buildings and other types of facilities. That means that there are opportunities within all of these sectors to reduce emissions. Now, the last thing I want to leave you with is this plot which shows predicted temperatures by the end of the century for summer. And you'll note that there are two lines out here. One, the red line, shows the prediction using the business as usual model, which is that we just continue to use energy at the current rate under the current types of technologies. This blue line shows what would happen if we were to implement the most rigorous conservation measures. You can see that there is a huge difference there, which accounts for about 10 degrees of potential warming that you and I in this room, our fellow citizens in Minnesota, have the potential to mitigate the amount of climate change in the future. And I leave that as a challenge for you. And thank you very much for inviting me. And I appreciate that you are undertaking this enormously important mission. Thank you.
It's my privilege tonight to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Lee Frelick. Dr. Frelick earned his PhD in forestry from the University of Wisconsin, Madison, in 1986. He is currently the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Hardwood Ecology in St. Paul. He is a senior member of the graduate faculty in the Natural Resources, Science and Management, Ecology and Conservation Biology programs. Dr. Frelick is also the chair of the Minnesota DNR Commissioner's Advisory Committee on Natural Areas and Non-Game Wildlife. Dr. Frelick has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. He has been on CBS Radio's Osgood Files. He has appeared in Newsweek and National Geographic. Dr. Frelick is listed among the top 1% of all scientists in the world by the Science Citation Index in the Ecology and Environment category. Dr. Frelick will be speaking on global changes or climate changes and their effects on Minnesota forests. Dr. Frelick.
Oh, members of the House and Senate, thank you for inviting me here. I'm honored and happy to be here to talk to you about the impact of warming on Minnesota's forests. And I'd also like to acknowledge my colleague, Professor Peter Reich, and his wisdom is reflected in this presentation as well as mine. Some people think global warming is a relatively new thing, but I found this interesting character, Svante Arrhenius, who in the late 1800s actually was the first one to come up with the greenhouse theory for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And in 1906, 100 years ago, he predicted a magnitude of temperature increase for increased CO2 in the atmosphere, which is about the same as we're predicting today. So leave it to the Swedes to be 100 years ahead of the rest of the world. These are some of the predictions from the United States Forest Service, their research branch in Delaware, Ohio, by Iverson and Prasad, and it shows how ranges of some of our trees might change in Minnesota with a warmer climate. And if you look at this map, the yellow here, for example, is the current range of balsam fir. 10,000 years ago, balsam fir, 15,000 years ago, was down here in Illinois and Missouri. When the climate warmed at that time and came to our current climate, it moved up to this yellow range here. And if temperature increases in the future, it will move even further north again. And you see the green there, which is the predicted range if we end up with a climate with double CO2 content compared to pre-industrial CO2 content in the atmosphere. So basically just the tip of Cook County might still have this species of tree. Here's another interesting species, hemlock. And the blue there is actually new territory for hemlock. Right now, Minnesota is too far north to have hemlock. But with a warmer climate, the Boundary Waters canoe area up in the Arrowhead might become favorable habitat for that species of tree. So trees have moved north in the past when the climate warmed, and they will do so if the climate warms again. Species that might be in danger in Minnesota of migrating out of the state or at least being greatly reduced in abundance are balsam fir, white spruce, black spruce, red pine, and jack pine. And you see pictures here of those species of trees in the Boundary Waters canoe area. There are a lot of forces actually at work in Minnesota pushing our forests more towards a savanna, which would be a vegetation type with scattered trees in a grassy matrix. Anytime the evaporation to precipitation ratio increases and soils get drier, the number of trees has to thin. If you have less water, you can support fewer trees. Global warming would cause warmer soils. It would cause more evaporation. We also have this European earthworm invasion at this point, which I'll show you in a minute, which is going to interact very strongly with global warming. They strip the duff, which is the leaf litter on the forest floor, and that's a type of insulation, and that is already causing our soils to warm up even in advance of global warming. So when the warming from global warming arises, it's going to be added on top of that caused by the earthworms. So there'll be a strong interaction. So Minnesota is unique in that we sit right at the prairie forest border. This is prairie and the pre-settlement vegetation. The orange and yellow up here is the boreal forest, the northern conifer forest of spruce and fir with some aspen and pine. And in the past when the climate changed, for example, 7,500 years ago when we were at the peak of the interglacial that we're in now, the prairie forest border was over by Eau Claire instead of to the west of the Twin Cities. And we're just reaching temperatures now, according to the recent paper that James Hansen published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we're just reaching temperatures now equal to what we had about 7,500 years ago. So I do expect that the prairie forest border might move. We might warm up considerably warmer than we were 7,500 years ago, and the prairie forest border could move a lot to the east if we end up with a much warmer and much drier climate. We're not completely sure, however, about future precipitation. We think there will be a net drying, but some models do show increased precipitation, which would allow northern conifer forests in Minnesota to transition over to a forest with pine, maple, hemlock, and oak, as opposed to an oak savanna. Now, Bud Heinzelman, who is the premier ecologist in the Boundary Waters, spent his whole life studying the Boundary Waters. His opinion, which is in the last chapter of his book, is that the Boundary Waters canoe area with a double CO2 climate will be an oak savanna. And this being a picture of Dave Tillman's study area at Cedar Creek. And that is a good analog for what northern Minnesota might look like with a much warmer and drier climate. Now, here's a simulation that the Canadians made about the boreal forest. And this is the spruce fir in this dark color here, hugging Lake Superior. And with a doubled CO2 climate, they're projecting that that will move northwards by about 300 miles. So to see the same forest type you see in the Boundary Waters today, you would have to go up to the north end of Lake Winnipeg or Lake Nipigon in the middle of Ontario to find the same type of forest in the future. What about disturbances? Wind and fire are very important in forests, and of course, if we do end up with a much warmer climate and drier soils, the frequency of large fires could increase. But not only that, the frequency of big windstorms. We have these windstorms in Minnesota known as derechos. And they are very severe thunderstorms that produce downbursts and damage paths at least 250 miles in length. This is a derecho frequency map for the 1980s and 90s. And what we have here is the derecho triangle from Dallas to Minneapolis to Pittsburgh. And within that triangle is the highest frequency of these severe thunderstorms of any place in the world. Now, if you think about the forests up here in northern Minnesota, if the climate shifts 200 or 300 miles further north and they start getting derechos every year instead of every few hundred years like they did in the past, I can guarantee a pretty spectacular result. If you put one of these severe windstorms in Iowa, it doesn't matter much what's going to blow down in Iowa. But if you put a severe windstorm like that up in the boreal forest with all these tall, spindly spruce trees that are like a Christmas tree on top of a flagpole, it's going to flatten millions of acres of forest, and that's exactly what happened in the 1999 blowdown that you see there, where the whole landscape for 50 miles was flattened. And so an increased frequency of these big windstorms would be a serious event for the forests of northern Minnesota. We have an overpopulation of deer in much of the United States, especially the northern tier of states. There's a massive consensus among scientists that these deer are causing extinction of many different species of plants. And in Minnesota, of particular interest are white cedar, yellow birch, white pine, and the oaks, which are hard to regenerate now because the deer eat all the seedlings. Well, if global warming is going to remove species from our system, and deer are also going to remove species from our system, these impacts are going to be compounded with one another. Then we have the earthworm invasion that I mentioned a few minutes ago. These earthworms from Europe strip the duff. Here's a healthy forest floor before invasion, and there's after. You see the recession of the forest floor there. It was about 6 inches thick, and it's gone down to almost nothing. Well, that's 6 inches of insulation that's gone, and that is going to warm the soil during the summer. And warming of soil is a very serious concern for forests because the temperature that roots experience is actually one of the most important things determining the health of trees. And a lot of our northern trees are sensitive to warming soil, and when we do have a warm, dry summer, root mortality does lead to declines in the health of the tree. So global warming plus the earthworms removing our natural insulation layer will compound with each other. They will interact and reinforce each other's impacts. Then we have insects, and it turns out that even native insects play a major role in forest change when there's a warming climate. And a good example of that is the mountain pine beetle in British Columbia, which has killed about 30 million acres of forest of lodgepole pine. It's a native insect there. And because of warmer winters, it now is able to breed much faster and has much more survival over winter. And so it's killed 30 million acres. That's an area about the size of the state of Pennsylvania. And it turns out that this beetle can also live in jack pine. And we have jack pine forests all across Canada, across northern Minnesota, all the way out to Quebec. This beetle has now moved over the continental divide. It's on the east side of the divide. All it needs to move across the boreal forest is the absence of 5 or 6 days of minus 40 degrees per winter, and that will allow this thing to have a population explosion and spread across the boreal forest.
and untold millions of acres of forest in Minnesota and in Ontario and all the way across to Quebec are at stake for that. In Minnesota, we also have some native insects that are causing problems. The eastern larch beetle has caused heavy mortality on about 54,000 acres since the year 2000, and according to the entomologists at the DNR, this is because of warmer winters and greater survivorship of this insect, which has been able to have an outbreak in its population in infest trees. Then we have our exotic insects. Native insects can become a problem if they start to breed faster, but we have exotic insects like the emerald ash borer, the Asian longhorn beetle, the hemlock woolly adelgid, which have been introduced from Asia and are on their way. The emerald ash borer here is capable of killing all species of ash. This is the susceptibility map put out by the Forest Service. Orange and red means susceptible forest, and as you can see, we in the upper Midwest here have a bigger acreage of susceptible forest because we have a lot of ash than any other part of the country. These blotches that you see are cities that after Dutch elm disease went through and killed the elm trees, they replanted with ash. And now they're going to lose their ash. The emerald ash borer is in this region in southern Michigan and Ohio. It's just been found in Chicago, in the Chicago suburbs, so it'll be on its way to Minnesota pretty soon. And a warmer climate will facilitate the movement of these types of exotic species. So here's a summary of impacts here. Global warming is going to directly impact jack and red pine, the spruces and fir. Sudden oak death, which is another introduced disease I didn't mention yet, could impact the oaks. Deer could impact cedar, yellow birch and white pine, the emerald ash borer, the ashes, Asian longhorn beetle, the maples and aspens, hemlock woolly adelgid for the hemlock. The mountain pine beetle could come here if we stop having minus 40 degree temperatures in the winter in northern Minnesota. We all already have our native insect problem with larch. The earthworms are very heavily impacting sugar maple forests, and rate of migration, in other words, whether these trees will be able to migrate north fast enough to keep up with the new climate, that will affect all species. There's a chance that these trees will not be able to migrate fast enough. And you might ask, what does this leave? This is a list of trees with potential problems. Well, right now, basswood looks really good. There's no disease coming for basswood that we know of, and not only that, it can withstand very warm summers. I just found a nice basswood forest out by Kanda Yohai, an old-growth basswood forest in a place that has much warmer, drier summers than we have even here in the Twin Cities. So basswood's looking pretty good right now. So the overwhelmingly the main point of this presentation is that global warming is here, and all of these other problems are going to reinforce its impact. The invasive earthworms, the high deer populations, the exotic insects, possibly increase in fires and wind in the future, they're all going to reinforce the impact of global warming on our forests. And so that makes it very important that we do as much as we can to stop global warming, to blunt its impact as much as we can. Transitions in forests are a messy thing. I've looked into the paleoecological literature where we've looked at incidences in the past where either an insect has invaded a forest or there's been an unusual climatic event. And what usually happens is a threshold is reached and the forest dies very quickly. The old forest dies very quickly. And there's a transitional vegetation type and recovery takes several centuries. Forests are very complicated ecosystems, and it takes several centuries for a new ecosystem to develop. And so if we start with conifer forests in northern Minnesota and say we have three summers in a row like the summer of 1988, and they die and they look like this, and maybe they're going to transition over to oak savanna, or maybe if we stop the growth of CO2 content of the atmosphere, maybe we can maintain forests in Minnesota. But if we do reach some threshold where they die suddenly, we'll be in this transition for several centuries, because forests live on the scale of centuries and millennia, not on the scale of annual years or decades like people do. This is a graph from Hansen's paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It was produced in 1988. The blue line here was his prediction for increasing temperature, and as of the year 2006, you see the red data plotted on here. That is the actual observed, and as you can see, his prediction for the year 2006, made in 1988, is an exact match for the actual temperature observed in 2006. And so it looks like scientists' predictions are coming true, not to mention Svante Arrhenius' predictions made in 1906, which are also coming true. However, if we were to implement some of the items that Dave Tillman talked about, renewable energy, green buildings, more efficient appliances, and so on, and were to decrease or stabilize the CO2 content of the atmosphere, our temperatures might level off and might not get much warmer. And this is just to reiterate, this shows 160,000 years of CO2 in the green line here. This is where we are now. That's where we might stabilize if we reduce CO2 emissions as much as we can in the next few decades. This is where we're going to go with business as usual, and I believe that would actually be as high as it's been in 30 million years if we do get up to that level. So we would really be taking the world to a new place where we wouldn't really have any idea what was going to happen. But I don't think we really need to go there. Here's some predictions for potential future temperatures. Here's the temperature for the last 1,000 years. Here's the increase we've seen recently. And here's where we might go. A big range here from another degree Celsius up to 6 degrees Celsius, which is about 11 degrees Fahrenheit. We're in the middle of the continent. If you're in the middle of the continent, the temperature change is probably going to be twice what it is for the global mean, so 20 degrees warmer. Actually, the only weather station I found that is 20 degrees warmer in the summer than Minneapolis was Phoenix, Arizona. We're about 72, and their average is about 92. But we don't need to go there. If we start limiting CO2 emissions, develop alternative energy and energy conservation, and we can stabilize CO2 at a lower level, it might only warm up a little bit, and we might hang on to forests in Minnesota. We could manage that change. We could still have forests. Maybe we wouldn't have quite as many conifers. We'd still have infiltration of oaks and maple into our conifer forest. But we could still hold on to a forest with a minimum amount of climate change, I think, in the future. And so we need to implement these things immediately. And I don't think we have much of a time window. James Hansen says if we don't cut emissions dramatically in the next 10 years, our time window is up, and it'll be too late to reverse a lot of the changes caused by global warming. And I agree with that statement. And that's where I'll leave it. Thank you for inviting me.
We'll take some questions for the presenters. If you'd like to maybe just raise your hand and shout out your question, and then I'll repeat the question into the microphone. Yes, Representative Taylor.
Thank you.
question was conservation alone or renewables as well. Why don't you come up to the microphone?
I use the term conservation in quotes because it implies a scenario in which not only conservation measures, but use of alternative fuels and a whole package of changes are implemented. That is, every effort is made to reduce the amount of emissions, and it's just based on the different types of scenarios that are used to calculate these predictions into the future.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Olsey.
Yeah,
question was about gasification of coal and injecting the byproduct into the ground.
Right. I'm not an expert, but I have friends who are who I've talked with quite a bit about this. You can use basically liquefied carbon dioxide as a way to extract oil from wells that have otherwise run dry, and so it's called tertiary oil recovery. So if you have something like an oil well, which you've basically already vacated a lot of material from it already, you can pump it full of carbon dioxide, which you capture from a coal gasification plant. You can use it to extract more oil, and then you can seal the well off, and the estimates are from the geologists who've looked at this that you can, if done properly, you can have that carbon dioxide stay in the ground for a very long time. I don't know how long, I don't know how to guess, but a time that is very long compared to our concern about greenhouse warming. So that is one possibility. So and the other advantage of gasifying coal, we have a lot of it, and if you gasify it properly, you can also remove the sulfur and the mercury, which are not removed when you burn it in an open chamber as we do in fluidized bed reactors. So coal gasification is something we could think about. We don't have many empty oil wells in Minnesota that we can use as a repository for this oil. So it's probably a technology that's better suited for, let's say, Texas or Pennsylvania or other places where there's a lot of old oil wells.
Other questions? Yes, sir. And I apologize. I don't know your name. Question for Dr. Tillman was, what are the top three things Minnesota can do right now?
You put me on the spot. I wasn't anticipating this question, but I can tell you my thoughts on this. First, we have made a viable biofuel in ethanol, but it is not a greenhouse neutral fuel. We can change it to a greenhouse neutral fuel by having biomass that I mentioned be the source of energy for running ethanol plants. And that biomass is biomass which we know prairie biomass does, and maybe woody biomass does it too, but I haven't seen the research on that, which stores enough carbon in the soil. We can have that be a viable carbon neutral fuel for us. So that would be one step. The whole issue of energy conservation, transportation, mass transit, housing, those areas, if you will, of energy efficiency are a very big agenda item where we could have a big impact. Finally, we can manage lands in ways that can help us help them become better at removing and sequestering carbon. And that's off the cuff. I mean, I may be missing an even better idea. And maybe you have one, Lucinda? But I don't want to. We need a diversity of ideas for these issues.
Certainly, the issue of conservation is the one that is the cheapest and the one that we can all implement in our homes, in our businesses, in our governments, everywhere. The other issue is that we can certainly do something about our gas mileage standards here in the state, similar to what other states have done. And an action that could be taken immediately this session would be to set real timelines in terms of the reduction of emissions across the board or across different sectors.
Further questions?
Yes. How far, well, first of all, Representative Knuth was appreciative of Dr. Tillman. How far are we from using plant biofuels for other purposes?
Right, so, and one of the main purposes that is being pursued now is using it for ethanol production, so cellulosic ethanol. The papers that are written on this by the people who are studying it suggest that it looks as if, let me tell you one of the problems. The problem is how to cheaply break cellulose, which is a whole string of sugars. It's like a sugar hook, sugar, 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 long, long chain of sugars. How to cheaply break them apart into the single sugars, each single sugar, so those sugars can then be eaten by yeast or bacteria, converted into alcohol. And there are enzymes to do this, but right now those enzymes are not very cheap. That is really the biggest step. And the people who are working on the enzyme technology and so on estimate that within 5 or so years, they think it would be cheaper to make ethanol from cellulose, from grasses or woody biomass, than from corn. And that when that technology hits that level, there will then be a lot of motivation for people making ethanol to modify their plants so they can use cellulose as their feedstock and not corn.
Representative Earhart. Just a comment from Representative Earhart that if we raise the gas tax, there would be incentive to move to more fuel-efficient cars and mass transit.
I think I heard him say like 50 cents a gallon.
Other questions before Senator Murphy? Senator Murphy would like to provide some conclusionary remarks, and then we have some thank yous.
Yes. First, I want to thank all the presenters that came today, and especially to Will Steger, who took his time not only to come here today, but to come and visit me on a one-on-one basis last year. I get a call, and I'd like to have a meeting. And I thought, you know, this is a guy that, what's he doing wasting his time with me? I'm just some slug from Red Wing. I'm glad you came. Because until I talked to you, I had only given lip service to climate change, global warming issues. I can tell you from working in the utility industry for the past 25 years that the industry even gets it. Duke Power is moving ahead. Xcel Energy is moving ahead. They're turning coal into gas plants. They're looking at other technologies. And I'm converted, much like Senator Langseth converted me on the seatbelt issue. I'm converted, and I'm dedicated towards the process, and I would hope that all of my colleagues would join in that sentiment today, because we have a lot at stake here. It's not us. It's our kids, our grandkids, and those generations that are going to come. We all know that. What can we do? Representative Earhart, you're right. We can start off by increasing the price of gasoline. The OPEC nations have no problem in doing it. Why don't we do it so we can capture that money and keep it here in Minnesota? That's number one.
Number two, we have to get on board with Senator Anderson, Senator Solon, and the folks over in the House that are working on the 25-25 or 30-25 initiative or whatever we want to call it. It is attainable. We can do it, but we can't do it without leadership from these individuals that came to present today and without our own courage to stand up and tell people we have to do this. It is important. We need flex fuel vehicles. We need an electric industry that is going to move ahead. I think we've got their attention now. Above all, we need to be bold and aggressive, and we can't wait till tomorrow. Tomorrow's not an option. We have to do it today. We have to be bold, aggressive, and we have to do it today. Is that right, Senator Anderson? That's right. So I challenge everybody in this room, if you have a certificate in your hand that says you're an elected representative, take it out, shop it, and see what you can buy. And I tell you what, people are behind you. Our constituents are behind us, so let's have the courage to move ahead. Let's do what Will Steger has done. Go around the planet and tell people this is a good deal. Let's just get her done. Thank you.
Yeah. Said, Senator. We would like to thank the chairs of the Environment Committees, Senator Ellen Anderson, Chair of the Environment, Natural Resources, Finance Division, Chair of the Senator Pretner Solon, who is Chair of the Senate Energy, Utilities, Technologies, and Communications Division, Senator Steve Murphy, Chair of the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Division in the Senate. We'd like to thank our House Chairs, Representative Jean Bouguinas, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Budget Division in the House, Representative Ken Eakin, who chairs the Environment and Natural Resources Committee in the House, and Representative Bernie Leader, and I'm not sure if he... There you are. You sit so quietly and patiently all the time, but you're a powerhouse in your own. We want to thank you as well for co-sponsoring this event. Which chair did I miss? I apologize, Representative Hilty. Of course, you're my favorite house. chair of the House Energy Committee. This was a truly historic event. At no time have eight House and Senate committees ever gathered together jointly to hear a particular topic. And, of course, never use these chambers for a committee presentation. This is a truly historic day. And this day, this presentation, would not have been able to be pulled off without the tremendous efforts of all of our committee staff. So if all the committee staff would please stand up and let us give you all a round of applause. This was such a well-organized event. Mary Ann, others? Thank you. And, of course, all of our presenters. We'd like to thank the bishops for talking about the moral impact of global warming. Will Steger for presenting us with the images of global warming. Dr. Tillman talking about the science behind global warming. Dr. Johnson about the impacts of global warming, particularly on our waters. And Dr. Freelich talking about the impacts of global warming on our land and our forests. There were many others that we could have brought forward today, but time simply did not allow. Ranging from sportsmen, the business community, the insurance community, agricultural interests, and, of course, even those who still believe that the issue of global warming is not as great as purported. But today, I think we have provided the necessary beginning to all of our, as policymakers, understanding of global warming. More than just the word, now we are beginning to understand the depth of the issue. The concern is real, and it's on a planetary scale. It's on a planetary scale. When Will Steger talks about a planetary event, that scares me. We are doing things to this Earth,
that are damaging it on a global scale. But we have the opportunities, as we heard today, to make a difference. And the opportunity for change is not as undaunting as it may seem. So, we, as policymakers, have the opportunity. We have the power to act. So, let's listen. Let's think. Let's act. And let's do it today. Thank you all for being here.